36. 2 days after giving a green light to a weekend movie and workout at the gym, Fauci appeared on MSNBC on March 2nd, sounding subdued and wearing a white coat. "We're dealing with an evolving situation," he said. "The disease had now reached outbreak proportions and likely pandemic proportions if you look at multiple definitions of what a pandemic is. The fact is, this is multiple sustained transmissions of a highly infectious agent in multiple regions of the globe." Redfield monitored the CDC's Influenza-like Illness Surveillance Network, which took in daily reports from health institutions across the country tracking influenza types A and B. This would let epidemiologists anticipate when the flu was coming. Redfield looked at the beautiful curves it produced. Influenza B peaked and then fell. Influenza A peaked and then fell. Now, in March, it was on its way down as flu season ended. But then a third peak appeared. Redfield had never seen a third peak before. On March 3rd, Trump visited the National Institutes of Health in Maryland, where he was photographed speaking with doctors wearing white coats in a room bristling with scientific equipment, just as campaign manager Brad Parscale had advised. 3 days later, Trump toured the CDC in Atlanta, Georgia, in a red Keep America Great campaign hat, khaki pants, and an open-necked shirt under a bomber jacket. Speaking at the CDC, Trump promised, "Anybody that needs a test can have a test," seeming to contradict widespread reporting about the difficulty of being tested. Administration officials later worked to clarify that people need to go through their doctors or public health officials to access testing. "We're not blind where this virus is right now in the United States," Redfield told reporters as he stood beside Trump. "I tell people, every time we see a new confirmed case, they should think of that as a success, because they know their public health community is out doing their job." Chief among the lessons Redfield had learned from his days researching HIV was not to get ahead of the data. HIV was initially thought to only be transmitted by homosexual sex. Early on, he questioned this and co-authored studies demonstrating it could be transmitted heterosexually as well. As important as it was to let people know what kind of road a disease would take them down to prepare them, the moment he got ahead of the data, he would lose his credibility. When the CDC spoke, he wanted people to listen. He told people he was a data guy, not an opinion guy. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, a brash Twitter-using nationalist whom Trump had labeled the Trump of the tropics, was in Florida in early March and wanted to come to Mar-a-Lago to see Trump. National Security Advisor O'Brien was cutting back on foreign visits for the president because it looked like the virus was becoming a concern in the United States. An exception was made for Bolsonaro. A photo opportunity was arranged, but it morphed into a dinner for Saturday night, March 7th. Trump and Bolsonaro sat at a table with O'Brien, Ivanka, Kushner, and some of the other Brazilians traveling with Bolsonaro. O'Brien was later notified that three of the Brazilians at the table, but not Bolsonaro, tested positive for COVID-19. After this became public, Bolsonaro downplayed the virus as part of a fantasy. O'Brien had an entirely different reaction. He worried he might be a historical footnote as the person responsible for exposing Trump to the virus or passing it directly to him. He spent a lot of time with Trump. There was not lots of testing available then, but he arranged to be tested. He was negative. Later, Bolsonaro tested positive. The virus was starting to feel real. On March 9th, with the stock market reeling, Trump tweeted, "Last year, 37,000 Americans died from the common flu. It averages between 27,000 and 70,000 per year. Nothing is shut down. Life and the economy go on. At this moment, there are 546 confirmed cases of coronavirus with 22 deaths. Think about that. The New York Times headline the morning of Tuesday, March 10th. Markets spiral as globe shudders over virus. The markets had plunged the day before. The Times wrote it was their sharpest drop in more than a decade. In remarks to reporters following a meeting with Republican senators, Trump said, "We're doing a great job with it, and it will go away. Just stay calm. It will go away." Virus cases in the United States were up by more than 200 from the day before. O'Brien watched TV in his office, flipping between the cable networks. Italy was getting worse. There were images of people bleeding out and dying in the parking lots of Italian hospitals, not able to get in. This in a major Western country with relatively good health care. As the virus was spreading rapidly across Europe, O'Brien called several of his counterparts there, national security advisors or equivalents. The Chinese travel restrictions were having significant impact. In January, before the restrictions, some 500,000 travelers had come from China to the U.S. In February, there was an 86% reduction to 70,000. "We've stopped most travel from China," O'Brien told his counterparts. "You should do the same." The response was that this was an issue for the European Union in Brussels. Europe had to respond collectively. Italy was being hit hard and had, on March 9th, imposed restrictions nationwide on domestic travel. Nearly 140,000 had come from Italy to the United States the previous month. Another 1.74 million had come from the other European countries, such as France and Germany. O'Brien was worried there was a hole in the original travel restrictions from China. Many of the Chinese who would have come to the United States, were it not for the travel restrictions, had instead traveled to Europe. The other key player recently appointed to the team was Dr. Deborah Birx, whose decorated career as a physician, HIV/AIDS researcher, and diplomat in federal government spanned more than 40 years. She was named the response coordinator for the White House Coronavirus Task Force. Birx had spent most of her career in the search for a vaccine for HIV, and in 2003 had helped lead the clinical trial that produced the first evidence of any vaccine to be effective in lowering the risk of HIV. Also, the U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator at the State Department, she had worked closely with Fauci and Redfield throughout her career. Birx reported that 35 states had COVID-19 cases now, and 30 of those had been traced to travelers that had come from Europe, primarily through John F. Kennedy Airport. O'Brien, Pottinger, Fauci, and Redfield thought it was well past time to restrict travel from Europe. A meeting was scheduled with Trump for the morning of March 11th. At the time, Kushner was intensely focused on an initiative to plant 1 trillion trees. Mark Benioff, the CEO of Salesforce, had brought the idea to Kushner, who brought it to Trump. "Everyone is pro-tree," Benioff said. Trump had made it one of the endless stream of tasks he had assigned to Kushner, who was throwing himself into it with typical business school efficiency. But now the word came from his father-in-law that he needed immediate help on the mounting COVID-19 crisis. In the Oval Office that morning, there was a consensus among the national security and health officials that they needed to act immediately to close down travel from Europe. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin was opposed. Travel from Europe was about 5 times that from China. "This is going to bankrupt everyone," he said dramatically. "It's going to destroy the economy." "What data are you relying on for that?" asked Birx. "You've been asking me for my data. What data do you have?" Mnuchin said that was how the economy and markets worked. Trump eventually approved the travel restrictions. They would be consistent with his decision on China. Kushner assisted with drafting the primetime television address that Trump had decided to give that night from the Oval Office. It was only the second of his presidency. A nationally televised evening address gave the speech the stamp of important business. That afternoon, the World Health Organization officially declared COVID-19 a pandemic. This is the most aggressive and comprehensive effort to confront a foreign virus in modern history, Trump said at 9 that evening. From the beginning of time, nations and people have faced unforeseen challenges, including large-scale and very dangerous health threats, Trump read. This is the way it always was and always will be. It only matters how you respond. The president announced he was halting travelers from most European countries for the next 30 days. Last week, I signed into law an $8.3 billion funding bill, he said. Several hundred times that would soon be required. The vast majority of Americans, the risk is very, very low, Trump said. Wash your hands. Clean often used surfaces. Cover your face and mouth if you sneeze or cough, and most of all, if you are sick or not feeling well, stay home. He made no mention of social distancing, staying 6 feet apart from others, and urged only those who were sick or not feeling well to stay at home. This is not a financial crisis. This is just a temporary moment of time, he said, reaching to calm the markets. The virus will not have a chance against us. Our future remains brighter than anyone can imagine. The speech received poor reviews. Trump seemed depleted on air, not in command of the material. He displayed none of the verve of the spontaneous, engaged, true believer of his political rallies. Peggy Noonan wrote the next day in the Wall Street Journal, "The president gave a major Oval Office address Wednesday night aimed at quelling fears. It was generally labeled unsettling." That day, March 11th, marked the beginning of a new consciousness in the country. There were over 1,000 cases and 37 deaths in the country. Colleges across the U.S. announced they were suspending classes. The actor Tom Hanks said that he and his wife Rita Wilson had tested positive for COVID-19 and would quarantine. More dominoes fell. The next day, the NCAA announced it was canceling basketball tournaments and suspending all remaining games for the season. Trump acknowledged he would likely have to cancel his upcoming rallies. Broadway theaters closed. Testifying before Congress, Fauci said that testing for the virus was failing. I mean, let's admit it. The distribution of faulty test kits had prevented officials and scientists from getting a clear picture of the number of infections in the crucial early days of the virus's spread across the U.S. By the beginning of March, fewer than 500 tests had been conducted. The Dow Jones fell 10% on March 12th, prompting the New York Times banner headline, "Worst Rout for Wall Street Since 1987 Crash." A giant chart on the front page of the Wall Street Journal showed the surging growth in the Dow from the early days of Obama's 8-year presidency and the first 3 years of Trump's. Then it fell off the cliff, down 20% since 2009. On March 13th, Trump declared a national emergency, the sixth of his presidency. He also announced the launch of a Google-related website that could determine whether a test is warranted and to facilitate testing at a nearby convenient location. This would cover the country in large part. Shortly after, Google tweeted that the tool in one of its small subsidiaries was still in development and was only intended to cover the Bay Area. For 2 days straight that weekend, every story on the front page of the Washington Post was COVID-related. Americans cleared store shelves of hand sanitizer and toilet paper. The White House began instituting temperature checks. New York City announced the closure of its schools. Matt Pottinger moved out of his small office in the National Security Advisor's West Wing suite to an office in the Eisenhower Executive Office Building. This would keep him and O'Brien separate, so one would be able to run the NSC if either got sick. Pottinger began wearing a mask and handed them out to the NSC staff working in the Situation Room. He couldn't require the staff to wear masks, but he urged them to. He and O'Brien had been using hand sanitizer for weeks. Birx, Fauci, and Kushner had privately been exchanging drafts of guidelines that would ask Americans to take 15 days to slow the spread of the coronavirus and effectively shut down the country. They'd sent them back and forth a few times, and Jared Kushner had looked at a draft and made some comments. Kushner's team worked on it for almost 24 hours straight, wrote it up with Derek Lyons, the staff secretary, then sent it to Fauci. When Kushner got involved, it seemed to Fauci that meant the president would know more detail. No doubt Kushner would explain everything to him. That's good, Fauci thought, because that gave them a direct line to the president. When Senator Lindsey Graham first heard early discussion about shutting down the country, he thought it was crazy. Then he saw projections of possible 2.2 million dead. I'm no expert here, Graham told Trump, but if these projections are anywhere near right and you ignore them, you're going to have a unique place in history. Mr. President, if these things are remotely right and you don't act, it would be devastating to your presidency. Trump gathered his team in the Oval Office that Sunday, March 15th. Pence, Mnuchin, Fauci, and Birx crowded around the Resolute desk. Fauci and Birx unrolled the guidelines to Trump. Physical separation is the key, they said. We should close down for at least 15 days to see what happens. They wanted to ask all Americans to work and attend school from home, to avoid gatherings of more than 10 people, to stay away from restaurants and bars, and to avoid traveling, shopping, and visiting loved ones at nursing homes. They would recite the now familiar public health litany. Wash your hands, don't touch your face, sneeze into a tissue, and disinfect surfaces. The final draft shows the weakness of having too many hands on the drafting process. Nowhere do the guidelines urge social distancing, staying 6 feet away from others, one of the most effective universal mitigations. If we can follow the guidelines for 15 days, they said, and close everything down, perhaps we can start to flatten the curve. In other words, to spread out the number of infections over time to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system all at once. As Trump listened, Fauci and Birx went back and forth with a skeptical Mnuchin. I'm concerned about what's going to happen economically, Mnuchin said. Well, you know, Trump finally said, let's try it for 15 days. Maybe we'll be able to open up for Easter. I don't think we should guarantee that, Fauci said. We won't be able to see the effect yet after 15 days. Okay, let's give it a shot, Trump said. I'm worried, Mnuchin said, but he didn't fight the decision. That day at the briefing, Trump said, this is a very contagious virus. It's incredible, but it's something that we have tremendous control over. That same day, Kushner got another grim wake-up call. He was working on ramping up more testing sites and went to a briefing at the Health and Human Services offices. We've got bad news, he was told. There are only 1.2 million swabs available for administering tests in the country. It was a brutal realization. After being involved for 4 days, the scope of the problem was becoming clear. What good were tests if you didn't have the swabs to administer them?